this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes and Melissa Bernardin, who's been coaching us in Zoom. So I need to just recognize you, Melissa. As we begin every show, first I usually tell you about the weather. So I don't know what the weather's going to be like on Wednesday, but I can tell you on Tuesday when we actually taped the show, it was spectacularly beautiful, except we had 8 inches of snow last night, but it completely melted by this morning. But I have broken branches in my backyard. So there you go. Anyway, we begin every show with the powerful words of Colonel Vindman as he testified in November of 2019 during the course of the impeachment hearings. We're going to be playing this every day. You're going to commit it to memory. But the reason why I want you to hear these words over and over again is that in November of 2020, remember Vindman when he assured his father, "It'll be okay, Dad. I'll be all right." Not only is he not all right, we are not all right. Now for the words of Colonel Vindman. Okay.
Arnie, can I just interrupt? And starting with in the midst of this coronavirus epidemic, let me tell our listeners to check out a really important posting by Jonathan Smith. He's a professor at Yale School of Public Health. Mm-hmm. And his warning is not very long, but it really goes to the heart and is very clear and very ominous to tell people why it's really important to stay inside and get control of this virus, and it's no joke, and you better do it now. So again,
we'll send me the link and I'll put it up on Facebook.
Jonathan Smith.
Everyone is warning about the same thing, except for President Trump. I just want to let you know, he's kind of on an island to himself. He and Lloyd Blankfein, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, the two of them are like singing Kumbaya, but ignore them. But I don't want to ignore my guest. So Sharon Kelly is an attorney and a freelance writer. She is based in Philadelphia. She's reported for the New York Times, The Guardian, The Nation, National Wildlife, Earth Island Journal, and a variety of other publications. And prior to beginning her freelance writing, she worked as a law clerk for the ACLU of Delaware. Boy, you're thematic. You're phenomenal. There were two pieces that I saw that I wanted folks to pay attention to. The first piece that sort of caught my eye was looking at the connection between the climate science deniers when it comes to climate change and those that were basically poo-pooing the idea that we needed to react in an aggressive way regarding COVID-19. The second piece that you wrote was regarding the coal industry asking federal lawmakers to cut funding for Black Lung Program. Ask me if I went apoplectic after I saw that. I can't even tell you. But I want to start with the connection between the climate science deniers and those that were really marginalizing any kind of real aggressive response to COVID-19, because it's not surprising to me that they would deny science once again. But at the same time, it really sort of tells me that the only science they believe in is the science of profits.
Well, so I think like what we wanted to do over at DSMOG is, at a higher altitude, we've perhaps all seen people like President Trump, like, for example, Jared Falwell Jr., some of those in the Trump administration, who have at times clearly spoken in ways that have been very dismissive of science, both on COVID-19 and on climate change. But we also wanted to sort of take a look from the bottom up to see what think tanks and what different organizations that host climate skeptics or climate science deniers, what they were saying, both early on and even more recently throughout March, about COVID-19. And we were sort of hoping to get some insight into how messaging might have circulated, not only from the top down, from the presidential level down, but also from the bottom up, from think tanks and political organizations up.
What I would call the echo chamber. I mean, it's like a push me, pull me, that kind of thing that's going on right now. And I've done a lot of research over the course of the years. And I love the names of groups because you should never trust anything by its name. The first group that you look at is the American Council on Science and Health. Oh my God, I want to send a donation now. Maybe not. Why don't you tell us a little bit about one of these groups?
Sure. I think we took a look at three organizations in particular that just sort of jumped out at us, as, you know, in part because of the level of influence that they might have in Washington, D.C., the messaging that they were circulating when it came to COVID-19. The American Council on Science and Health, you have the Cato Institute, and you also have the American Enterprise Institute. And one of the things that was really striking to me actually was if you took a look at there's a post by the American Enterprise Institute by one of their resident scholars, and the headline was coronavirus a bioweapon? ? We don't know, but history shows we can't trust China.
Keep going. It's so Donald Trump. Yeah.
And what that article did was it defended Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, who conducted a Fox News interview, basically circulating this theory, right? But if you take a look at where that theory came from and whether there's evidence to support it, et cetera, right? What you find is that, if you look at Snopes, for example, right, to fact check this claim, what you find is not only is there no set evidence to support that theory, but Snopes also interviewed experts who sort of highlighted how that would be a very illogical, action. And further, they found that some of the claimed evidence to support that theory actually traces back to a Reddit board that's dedicated to fiction stories.
Oh my God.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not surprising,
Sharon. Let me just stop you for a second. My daughter lives in Shanghai. So right at the beginning of this, when this was happening in Wuhan, there was also a theory that was being sort of circulated around that this was because of the United States, that we had planted, this horrific virus in Wuhan, and this was a plot by the U.S. So there's always been people that have been planting these stories. The problem is, what you're telling me is this is from a think tank called the American Enterprise Institute that is so, quote unquote, used by especially the GOP and Donald Trump to basically sort of mine for information and give them and support their talking points. And that's what makes where this is coming from kind of so frightening.
I don't know that the specific claim that was debunked by Snopes actually came from AEI, but I will say what AEI did in publishing that post is they sort of fanned the flames of this conspiracy theory, right? They give it a little bit of credence. They give it sort of entree into the circles where policy decisions are actively being made, right? And I think if this pandemic drives any message home, that I think is really important for all of us, it's the importance of acting based on verifiable information and scientific information that's most credible, because this is something that's really going to affect every single one of us potentially. Already is having massive impacts on the vast majority of us, and we will be best served if we pay close attention to what we know and what we don't know, and we differentiate between the two very carefully.
Well, again, let's remind the audience that at the Smog Blog, the title of your piece was Meet the Climate Science Deniers Who Downplayed COVID-19 Risks. I want people to understand why these two concepts are so unfortunately thematic. And that's where I want you to go back to, for example, the American Council on Science and Health. Sure. Because if you really want to look at the climate science deniers, this Council on Science and Health, who funds them, which I think you will include in our conversation, will not surprise anyone, because one of the reasons why we are in this really climate crisis right now is that a lot of the large energy companies have known for decades what was going to happen. But of course, they either denied it, they said it didn't exist, they didn't reveal their studies, and of course, then they funded things like the American Council on Science and Health. So why don't you tell the audience a little bit about this group with the nice name that shouldn't be trusted?
Oh, sure. So the American Council on Science and Health is an organization that dating back to 1997 at least, has taken positions that suggest that action on climate change is not necessary or important, or it should not be prioritized, right? They're an organization that's accepted funding, from fossil companies and their sort of affiliates, for example, from Mobile Foundation, specifically for their capacity to sort of, I believe the Mobile Foundation, I'm not quoting exactly, but we've taken a look at some of the Mobile Foundation's intentions in funding organizations like the ACSH, and what they said is they were looking for some, they valued ACSH because of their ability to act as a counterpoint to public interest organizations, sort of in debates generally about climate science.
So when they were looking for the fact that there was, this is the 1% of scientists that say that climate change isn't happening, as opposed to the 99% of the scientists who say that climate change is happening. And in your piece, this is like unbelievable. They purported pro-science advocacy groups, and they've labeled Greta Thunberg's activism as doomsday prophesizing. But this is my favorite, I think my favorite nugget in your article. And it has falsely suggested that climate change is less of a concern because more people die in winter than in summer. So if it gets warm, there'll be less of us dying. So you want the planet to warm up because then we'll all live longer. And as you point out in your article, actually, that's not true too.
Right. And I believe that there's actually a correction that's appended to that article, an update. That's not a correction. But you know, which reads, you know, is brought to my attention that this pattern of seasonal deaths is only to be expected in the rich world. Many of the poorer, more populated parts of the world are in or near the tropics, where summers are sweltering and winters are mild or non-existent. Thus, an increase in global temperatures would cause more deaths in these areas. So, you know, and this is appended to the end of that article.
I know, but it's like they're making crap up. I mean, it's just. But again, if you listen to Donald Trump, I mean, in a lot of ways, every time he says in a tweet or you hear him during a press conference, he said, and they have said, well, he's right. They have said. I think the group that said it was American Enterprise Institute. Yes, they have said it. So in a lot of ways, he can point to an organization that on its face sounds credible. But then when you look at their history vis-a-vis, for example, climate change, and then you realize their history now with COVID-19, you don't want to touch anything they say because it's kind of like nuclear waste.
I think like one possible way to look at this is to say that perhaps one of the unintended consequences of climate science denial is that we live in this culture where corporate funding has helped to maintain and offer a platform to think tanks and other organizations whose views fall very far outside of the scientific mainstream, right? So in the U.S., you have an entire infrastructure of think tanks whose experts weren't selected only because of their scientific bona fides, but because of their willingness to support views that funders sought, right, in the end of the day. And so when a pandemic strikes and we look to hear from those who have the most useful scientific expertise, it becomes more difficult to tell who is holding a title because of their scientific chops and their expertise and, you know, their accumulated knowledge and wisdom even, you know, versus who holds a title specifically because, you know, to borrow a phrase, you know, they've sought to bend light to hide truth.
Well, that's absolutely.
Could I just, Arnie, use that as a segue to go back to the key point that Sharon articulated earlier about acting based on accurate information and verifying it. And the issue is, how do you know what's accurate information and what's verifying it? And part of that is listening to the sources. And these sources, like ACSH with an Orwellian kind of name, where the name is the opposite of what it really does, like they really are not about public health, but about the opposite of public health, about maintaining corporate profits in without regard to whether public health takes place. And also, but I also want to mention that this inaccurate information become a problem long before Donald Trump. This is not a Trump problem. Think about the cigarette manufacturers who had all of these expert scientific publications that said no, cigarettes are safe. But they would cite those and nobody really knows which experts to listen to. And Sharon, isn't that the problem with listening to accurate information you gotta find out who has that.
But Sharon, I think the problem right now is, yes, this existed before. We've known it with the climate deniers. We've known it with cigarettes. Here's the problem with COVID-19. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We cannot afford misinformation at this moment because misinformation means 1,000 more deaths, 2,000 more deaths. The climate crisis has been eroding the climate for a long time. Cigarettes were eroding our health for a long time, but it wasn't like like a switch. You turn it on, you turn it off. I think the problem right now is, given the urgency of COVID-19 and what it means for people living or dying, what it means for the economy, what it means in the next hour, the next week, the next month, that's what makes this so, so damn tragic.
And I think, you know, this is where things like media literacy really come into play. right? Where you mm-hmm. want to look for organizations, you know, for example, you know, newspapers and publications that, that have an ombudsperson or have a corrections process or have, you know, you know, like some sort of accountability mechanism for, you know, to make sure that the information that they're presenting is accurate, right? That goes the publications where you have fact checkers, you know, whose job is to backstop whatever reporters write, right? Or, you know, organizations where, you know, peer-reviewed journals, right? You know, where
we live in the real world, and the real world is between 35 and 40% of the population only go to one source. They go to Fox, or they go to Rush, or they go to Donald Trump. And for them, that's their peer review. You know, that's their accurate source, because that has been the source that they've gone to over and over again. And until perhaps they die, and even after they die, they may blame someone else. Unfortunately, this is what stirs the pot when it comes to the kind of misinformation that's out there that's filtering through the system. And so ironically, we're not just fighting a pandemic, we're fighting lies. And we're fighting lies that are coming out of our leader, which is what makes this just so incredibly horrific. We just heard this week about this, you know, medication he was talking about over and over again. And a couple, you know, saw that they were feeding it to their fish. It had the same name. They took it. The husband's dead and she's in intensive care. But the only way they ever heard of this, the only reason why they thought it might work or even inoculate them, is that the president was putting out misinformation from a drug that hadn't been approved. And Dr. Fauci kept trying to tell him to shut up, or at least prevent him from saying it. But when you hear it coming from someone with the stature of president, then you would never think he'd be trying to kill you. But in the end, Trump is trying to kill you, which is a horrific thing to say. Before I let you go, however, what I really want to do is touch on the coal industry group. As I was thinking about COVID-19, I went immediately to West Virginia, actually, for two reasons. One of the poorest states in the nation. It is the state that has the highest opioid overdose in the country. So they're dying of this. And it's also the place where if you say coal, I think black lung. All right. And that's because so many of the miners there came home with such incredible illness and have been either slowly dying this horrible death, didn't have access to adequate health care. And I think there was even funding put into the ACA so that they would, in fact, be covered for the black lung problem. Your other piece that the coal industry is actually asking federal lawmakers to cut funding for the black lung program, citing COVID-19. COVID-19 should be the reason why they double the amount of funding for this, not the opposite. So just really quickly, tell my audience about their chutzpah.
What we found is what has been reported is this March 18th letter that was sent by the National Mining Association, right, which is a coal industry group. And it outlines the response that they seek from President Donald Trump and federal lawmakers on to the COVID-19 pandemic. And the first item that's in there is relates to attacks that's specifically on the coal industry, and it's used to fund the federal Black Lung Disability Trust Fund, right? And they call for actions that would effectively reduce the coal industry's payments by $220 million, you know, citing the financial pressures on the industry created by COVID-19. And, you know, I think, you know, if you talk to people at the UMWA, the United Mine Workers of America, you know, I think that they said it well, you know, where they basically said that if these cuts are allowed to go through, you know, how long are those cuts? Once you've made that cut, or once those disability that funding is no longer available, how long does that last, right? Because once those contributions are cut, you know, they argue, industry will argue that it should never be restored. You know, and these are people who are in particular personal danger because they have lung issues, you know, very clearly, from this pandemic. And so there's a huge,
I read that, and not only was I appalled at what they were suggesting, but I want to hermetically seal West Virginia so no virus can get in. Because if there is a place of vulnerability, this is a place of poverty. This is a place where everyone is walking around with a lung problem. I mean, it's just so frightening. And then to see them ask this, suggesting that COVID-19 was a problem for them. Yes, COVID-19 is a problem for them. They're right about that. But that's because they've left a landscape that's ripe for incredible, massive death. You know, they already are underserved with hospitals, they're already underserved with healthcare. This is the only opportunity to get any kind of access to healthcare is this fund. And then to suggest this, I know this just happened just the other day, March 18th. Do you know what the reaction was? I know that there's some, you know, there are a lot of bills that are swirling around. I just want someone to make sure that they're like reading the fine print to make sure that this isn't one of the things that someone slipped in, because what happens in complex bills with lots of money is that things get happen, and it's only after you've passed it that you find out.
I actually cannot speak to, I don't know, currently know what the status
Listen,
is.
Listen, someone, pay attention. Okay, keep going.
but I do know that the letter drew an immediate response from two members of the House of Representatives who, you know, identified some of the same issues that you're talking about here. You know, where, you know, talking about like communities that are still recovering from the legacy of all of the work damage to workers and also damage to the environment that was caused by the coal industry.
Well, it's these two articles are not surprising. I mean, I check the Smog blog a lot for information like this, and it's really important. I think part of the problem right now, especially as we're looking at these bills that are going through, and everybody's going to have their hand out, and you know what the lobbyists know. Not only do the lobbyists have an opportunity to sort of, you know, have access to senators that, you know, you and I don't have, unfortunately, the lobbyists control the EPA right now. Because when you look at, you know, the people who've been appointed by Donald Trump to the EPA, they have their fingers and their tentacles in the coal industry as well. So they have inside lobbyists, not just outside lobbyists. I think people need to understand that that's what's wrong with Donald Trump. It's not the boys outside that are cutting the checks to pay for the lawyers that are going to be their lobbyists. They have to know they actually wear titles inside the administration. So they have a dual strategy to get this in, which means we need to be more and more vigilant, especially because West Virginia is just so ripe for such massive debt. And knowing that, we need to be more aware of the kind of resources they're going to need. And more importantly, we have to make sure that they don't cut the funding for the Black Lung Fund, because that would just be the level of immorality I couldn't even possibly imagine. So thank you very, very much for doing this. And why does it not surprise me that if you deny climate change, you're probably denying the pandemic called COVID-19. Once again, everyone, I want to remind you that the only science that these boys like is the science of profits. You are expendable. Thank you so much for joining us, Sharon. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Stick around, everyone. A little Climate Connections is next. This is The Attitude.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many people avoid driving on icy roads, but in northern Canada's Arctic tundra, some roads are made of ice. A network of seasonal roads on frozen rivers and lakes allows trucks to reach remote areas. Many of these places are otherwise accessible only by boat or plane, but as the climate warms, the ice road season is getting shorter. Xiao Young of the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill analyzed more than three decades of satellite images of rivers around the globe. He looked at which rivers were frozen and when.
We detect widespread decline in river ice in the past 34 years. In general, we have later freeze-up of the river surface, and we have earlier breakup of the river surface. And that has consequences for when you can actually build these ice roads.
Young also studied what is likely to happen to river ice if global carbon pollution and temperatures continue to rise. He found that by 2100, some rivers could be ice-free for weeks longer than they are now. So global warming could continue to shorten the ice road season and make it harder and more expensive to reach some remote and isolated places in the Arctic. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1989. That was the day the Exxon Valdez oil tanker spilled nearly 11 million gallons of oil in Prince William Sound off the coast of Alaska. The ship ran aground and collided with Bligh's Reef. Most people remember the captain was held primarily responsible for the spill. By his own admission, he had passed out after a night of heavy drinking. But a number of factors also contributed to the environmental disaster. The National Transportation Safety Board issued its final report over a year later. In it, the board concluded that fatigue, reduced crews, and problems with regulations and procedures regarding Exxon's drug and alcohol program all contributed to the spill. Union officials reported great concern regarding chronic fatigue of its members on merchant ships, reduced crews due to greater automation, and reduced scheduled ship maintenance. Crew members on the Exxon Valdez routinely worked 20 hours or more a day during routine cargo handling operations. The NTSB also concluded that vessel traffic service under the U.S. Coast Guard failed to properly track the Exxon Valdez. They had the ability to select a higher radar scale, but didn't. The Coast Guard suffered from reduced crews burdened with increased job duties as well. They also found that remote communication sites were inoperable on the night of the spill. The equipment was old, deteriorating from harsh weather conditions. Requested funding for new equipment had not been forthcoming. The Alyeska Pipeline Company, for its part, failed to have an oil spill barge loaded and ready to go. Major cleanup efforts were conducted during the spring and summer months through 1992. But marine life and the environments were devastated. Long-term efforts at monitoring and cleanup continue today. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
To part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Of course, I want to remind you that Wednesday is taped on Tuesday, but you know, this is life in remote. Joining us right now is the executive editor of The American Prospect. And before he became the executive editor, I adored David Dayan because anytime he wrote anything, I would find him, but it wasn't as regular as it is now. And the best thing about him becoming the executive editor of The American Prospect is I know exactly where he is. I can read him every day and I can be always amazed at how prolific he is. Let me just give you a little bit of his background. His work has appeared in The Intercept, The New Republic, Huffington Post, The Washington Post, The LA Times, and more. His first book, Chain of Title, which we interviewed you for, by the way, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, was a winner of the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize. You have been doing yeoman's work regarding this whole COVID-19 pandemic. And I just recommend everyone go to prospect.org, and check out the COVID-19 daily report, because not only do you drill down into certain topics, but then you give us links to interesting things that a lot of people may not be paying attention to, because unfortunately we may be listening to Donald Trump, who we should avoid like the plague. but so there is so much value to what you write. When I first was looking at your COVID-19 report, I saw the story about the Amazon workers and about Amazon now, because as we've already known, they have been replacing the big box stores. They've been replacing Main Street even before this, but now that we're all basically sheltering in place, but we still need stuff. Amazon, of course, is now there to provide us with stuff. But the question of safety is important. The question of being overworked is important. The question is, what do you really need and why are you ordering it anyway, is my question. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about what's happening with the Amazon workers, because I think it's important, because in a lot of ways they are frontline, but they may not be getting the same kind of protection and attention as they should be, because they are crucial to this economy, especially since we can't go to a store. And this might be safer for us, but clearly less safe for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me on. So, this is accelerating, as you noted, the dominance of Amazon within the retail marketplace. It could be that once this all shakes out, we've got Amazon, Costco, and Walmart, and not much else, maybe some grocery stores. Those workers at the warehouses, the delivery workers, the frontline infrastructure for getting this vital set of supplies into people's homes is paramount there. And they're not seeing much of the benefit of Amazon's increase in market share. Amazon has said they're hiring 100,000 new workers to deal with the demand. They have offered them $2 an hour extra as a starting salary, so up to about $17 an hour. However, when I talk to workers who are actually in these facilities, there is no real new sanitary kind of mechanism. There's no hand sanitizer, wipes. They tell the workers to stand, and they've put tape out on the floor to tell them to stand 3 feet apart, which is half of the designation by the CDC and WHO of 6 feet. They don't get any sort of emergency pay or hazard pay. The only kind of extra pay is that they've made overtime double time now. So in order to acquire that, you have to spend 40 hours a week in that environment plus more to get the double time pay, right? So that benefits Amazon. It just makes the individual workers less safe. Now, there is one facility in Queens that one worker contracted the coronavirus, and they cleaned that facility, and I think they had it shut down for maybe a day, and then now people are back working there. And there are rumors of infections at other facilities across the country. And as you know, these warehouses are vast. They're absolutely mammoth facilities. And what hasn't changed, either in facilities like warehouses or delivery, is the speed in which these Amazon workers are forced to work. Right. And that's what creates all of the hazards to worker health, and also creates a lot of the close contact that you end up having, because you're moving around this warehouse very quickly from place to place. There are individuals who go station to station, so they can literally move, if they're infected, move this virus around throughout the entire warehouse. These warehouses could be very efficient conveyors of an infectious disease because of the way in which they operate.
Well, and that was all that kept going through my head. And I also want to remind you that it's not just Amazon that Bezos owns. He also owns Whole Foods. So we're talking right. about two sort of very essential things, your food, and then all the things that you may need to acquire, but can't go to a store because you're being told to shelter in place, or you're not, or the stores have been all shut down for the most part anyway. So as you're looking at this, you would think that he would be making more money hand over fist because he's like the only show in town, that it wouldn't only be about making sure that they got paid the amount, but you would make sure that they would have amazing health benefits, that they would have amazing time off, that they would absolutely have done the 6 feet, that everybody would be giving like a thousand kinds of gloves to wear and some kind of mask to wear, that in a lot of ways, not only are these people crucial for his profit, but they are now actually places, as you point out, that will actually disperse the disease if they don't take care of themselves. It's not only that they will get sick, but they will get sick and bring it into their communities because they were working with someone right next to them, which they've been told they need to do and they probably need to do financially. But in some ways, you want to make them almost as healthy as you want to make a nurse or a hospital worker.
Yeah, and as someone told me, you know, it's not worth putting yourself at risk and putting your whole community at risk and everyone you know for $17 an hour. I mean, that's not a good bargain. But these people are low-wage workers that don't really have a choice. They don't have a choice to opt out. And that brings us to sort of the sick leave policies and the leave policies of Amazon and what they've included and instituted. They have said that if you contract the disease, we'll give you 2 weeks off. Now, nobody can actually get a test to see that they have certainly been diagnosed as positive for coronavirus. So, getting that 2 weeks off is very difficult, right? There is various paid and unpaid time off that you can take. Unpaid time off is very hard for a low-wage worker. Like, oh, great, I can stay home and not get paid. At least I won't get fired. I mean, that's really the only benefit of that. And they have extended that for March, but not yet for April. So nobody is going to take that time off if they don't think it's going to be unlimited in April, which is, you know, only a week away. So there's a third way, which is if you're a contractor, because a lot of these Amazon workers aren't technically employees of Amazon, right, particularly around delivery, they're contractors. They have set up this thing called the Amazon Relief Fund, where if you're a contractor and you get COVID, or if you're quarantined, and by the way, it says in the statement, and this refers to employees and non-employees, that if you're quarantined by the government or Amazon, you can get this benefit, like as if Amazon is allowed to quarantine you. For this relief fund, you can apply, you have to fill out an application to apply to get what amounts to 2 weeks paid leave at $15 an hour. But all throughout this application, there is a discussion of how you can get your friends to donate to the Amazon Relief Fund. So like Amazon put in an initial fund of like an initial seeding of $25 million, but they're trying to get other people
other employees
to donate to them so they can pay their employees for these various leave policies.
All right, I'm not going to be apoplectic. I'm going to try to be calm here, but I'm going to remind everyone that the only reason why Amazon is paying $15 an hour is because of a guy named Bernie Sanders, who kind of shamed them. Am I right, David? Shamed them into sort of acknowledging this. I think this story needs to go back to Bernie and to Elizabeth. And again, because they're the only show in town now, then we need to have a camera on them. Then we need to have this story on them, because then Bezos, who's the richest guy on the frickin' planet, will then not only treat his employees better, protect them better, recognize his responsibility to the community, knowing he's making all this money. They shouldn't die for $17 an hour. They shouldn't poison the community for $17 an hour, so he can still be the richest man on the planet. I mean, at some point in time, this needs to be explained and understood, because these are frontline workers. These are important people. You know, the way we're now looking at, you know, people that work in grocery stores as being essential employees. And that term essential should mean that they're treated differently and they're protected more.
Well, one thing that's interesting about this is the reason that I learned so much about this is that there's this coalition called Athena. And Athena is a coalition of community organizations that are fighting Amazon on a whole host of issues, one of them being worker safety and worker conditions. And, Athena members were able to come to me and talk about life in these workplaces. And they are finding safety in numbers to be able to come together and work on this problem. So, the fact that we have a grassroots coalition now that is focused on, you know, making sure that when Amazon does well, as they are doing right now, it rebounds to the benefit of the workers who are actually creating the benefit, the creating all this wealth that Jeff Bezos and the Amazon treasury has, rather than just going to executive.
So David, the reason why I love the prospect, I love it. And I love what you write about. And I just want, is there a reporter at the Washington Post that's assigned to covering Amazon? I have to ask.
Maybe you have to ask the CEO.
Yeah,
the Washington Post.
I'm being cheeky here, but I almost think that every time you write about Amazon, they should put a private placement in the Washington Post, since we know they can't be accurate in their coverage, or that maybe they've been told not to cover it. They need to make sure that you are read in the Washington Post. So let's go to the other story that blew my mind. So I've been listening to Governor Cuomo, who has been really our sort of faux president, because as Donald Trump is someone you don't go to for direction, you don't go for understanding, you don't go for scientific information, you go to Andrew Cuomo. And Andrew Cuomo has talked a lot about two things, the Army Corps of Engineers and the Defense Production Act. And he has been banging on the door of Donald Trump saying, you said you were going to initiate it. You said you were going to initiate it. What's the problem? Why haven't you done it? And then I read your article and I wanted to have a heart attack, because the title of your article is The Gaping Hole in the Defense Production Act. And I thought the hole was Donald Trump, but there's another hole in the Defense Production Act. Can you tell my audience about this? This is shocking. Sure.
So let's explain what the Defense Production Act is.
Please.
It's a Korean War era law from 1950. It says that the government can enter into contracts with certain private businesses if the government needs certain supplies directly. And what happens is that contract supersedes the business plan of that particular company. That company has to, under the Defense Production Act, honor the government contract first before anything else that they're doing. Okay. And so that enables essentially takeover of the means of production, right? This is the government government saying you're going to build us ventilators, or you're going to build us face masks. You're going to produce face masks for us, and we're going to pay you for it. But we're able to centrally organize that and then get it out to the hospitals, in this case, that need it the most, right? Interestingly, the last time the Defense Production Act was used was in 2017, when Donald Trump saw a need in the increase in the space industrial base for the Space Force. That was actually used in 2017.
Really?
He invoked the Defense Production Act for that purpose. Now, if he invokes it, right, it's Venezuela. But he, when it was the Space Force at risk, he did it. But here's the problem. So the Defense Production Act, as I mentioned, is a transaction. The government is paying that private business to produce this material. And under the Defense Production Act, there's a cap on that fund, the fund that is used by which the government draws down to pay out these companies. And that cap, which probably made a lot of sense in 1950 when this was written, is $750 million. And $750 million is just not going to get you very far in the production of masks or ventilators, which cost $25,000, $50,000 a piece, or respirators, or any of these things. You would need to radically increase that appropriation up from $750 million, probably to $75 billion, if you were going to do it at scale.
My pulse is racing. So as I'm realizing that, does anyone know in Washington right now, while there's we're fighting with Schumer and McConnell and Trump and Pelosi, and we're coming out with a bill maybe this afternoon or maybe tomorrow, or God knows how, is there a line in any of these bills that are coming out to deal with the pandemic, as we're, sending money back to cities and towns and we're expanding unemployment? Is there a line for this? Because, poor Cuomo is knocking on the door, and I'm not sure he knows about the $750 million, but I'm going to make a recommendation to you. Get this to Andrew, because what Andrew needs to do is, the next time he holds one of those powwows on MSNBC and we all get to watch him, he needs to mention, oh, by the way, you need to up the ante. $750 million, if you're going to use this, isn't, part of the expression a pot to piss in, and that you need to make it $70 billion. But I think nobody knows this, and I didn't realize it until I read your piece.
Yeah, I think very few people know it. Ro Khanna, the congressman, has suggested that this appropriation needs to be expanded. In Nancy Pelosi's bill that she put out yesterday, they expanded it just to $3 billion. Which, that's better, but it's certainly not at the level that we need to meet these very critical needs. And this is the biggest thing happening right now, right? I mean, the inability for hospitals to care for patients is going to lead not only, in the case of personal protective gear, it's going to lead to more doctors and nurses becoming sick, which collapses the system in its own way. And it's also going to create these terrible Sophie's Choice kind of situations where you have to decide who gets the ventilator. So this is the real issue that's at hand, the near-term issue. And there's a very cavalier attitude that's going about how we're going to deal with this. Because if you don't do the Defense Production Act, you have every state and every hospital pitted against one another to try to buy these supplies from very few vendors. And the vendors then have all the power to dictate how much those are going to cost. And they're pitting governors and they're pitting hospital systems against one another. And we're just not getting enough for our money to get these things done. That's why it needs to be centrally coordinated by the federal government. And you have to have the amount, you have to have the reserves available to actually pull that off. And I don't think it's in the McConnell bill at all. If Pelosi's bill, you know, at least, you know, put the issue out there, it didn't do it to the degree that's needed. And more discussion needs to be made about this so that we can get not only get this running and pressure President Trump to act, but make sure it can be done at the scale necessary. Yeah.
Well, David, can I ask you? No, Ken, go on.
Can I ask you, it's sort of a process question, I guess, but it's relevant to what you were just talking about and making it realistic. And that is the process of congressional debate. And the more they debate it, the more there's no money going out to anybody. The more they talk about tweaks on how to make the disbursement of money better, the later it gets for things to start. And I know it's ridiculous to say that, you know, Congress is going to be flexible and nimble enough to put out some money today and debate, okay, the next batch is going to be in a week and the next batch in 3 weeks. But it seems that our political process is not geared towards making a rational decision, because a rational decision requires looking at the results, rethinking, taking a new step. How do we do that?
Well, not at all. I mean, Nancy Pelosi doesn't even want to bring the House back to deal with this. She wants to pass it by unanimous consent. So we're definitely not equipped, even in normal times, to deal with such a fast-moving crisis. And now that you have senators quarantined, House members quarantined, people afraid to get on planes to get back to Washington, no ability to do remote voting for Congress so that everybody can feel safe and also participate in these debates, it's a terrible, terrible situation. And this issue of funding for the Defense Production Act is just sort of a microcosm of all
in a way it's not a microcosm, because if we listen to what Andrew Cuomo says, and if I listen to what you just said, David Dan, it is, if we want to organize it, if we want to coordinate it, if we're going to get the kind of necessary life-saving equipment in a relatively timely fashion, then this is going to be essential. That's why he keeps begging for it. But the problem is, if he doesn't know, or someone hasn't, you know, threaded the needle for him to realize it's only $750 million, then what you're begging for will fail you before it even starts. So to a large extent, part of the reason why I want this story in front of his freaking face is that I want him, as he's saying it, to let people know this and say, this is double failure. Not only are you not switching it on when you say it's available to you, it's a power you have that will help us save lives and not compete with each other, but it needs to be funded. You are funding everything. This is essential too. This is about giving money to hospitals and frontline workers. Giving money to this means they get what they need in a timely fashion and they can be made.
Right. Now, there is in this new Schumer-McConnell negotiated bill, there is $100 billion for hospitals. And part of that, I think, would go towards equipment. Part of it would go towards housing frontline hospital workers and various other things. But part of it would go towards equipment. Now, the reason why just giving hospitals the money and having them do the purchases is worse than having the government do it and coordinate it at that level is because you have so few vendors, number one, and so the hospitals will be fighting one another to and increasing the price, so you're not getting the bang for your buck out of in terms of production. That's number one. But number two is that there are all these middlemen in the hospital buying process. There are these organizations called group purchasing organizations that takes their cut. They were intended to make the bulk purchases easier on the part of hospital systems. It would band hospital systems together to buy medical supplies or generic drugs. But they take a substantial portion of that for themselves. So under the Defense Production Act, you wouldn't have that middleman in the game. So there are a variety of
money.
Ways. David. So there are a variety of different ways why just giving this off to the hospitals doesn't make a lot of sense, especially when you need to get this done. You need to look at the big picture. Okay, Seattle needs it. New York needs it. This little hospital in Ohio that's willing to pay a lot for these things may not have the number of cases that requires it right now. We need to move these things. You know, you need to look at the big picture, and only the federal government can do that.
So the two articles I want everyone to go to is at the prospect.org. The most recent one is the Gaping Hole in the Defense Production Act. Remember that number, 750 million. Commit it to memory, share it with everyone, tweet it out. And the other one was Mind the Trust Gap. And that's the other article that you were kind of basically blending into at the end of this conversation about those group purchasing organizations. That explains why we're going to be competing with each other. Someone's going to be skimming off profits. And instead of this money going to frontline workers, it's going to be going into someone's pocket. And the only pocket I want it to go to is the pocket that makes the face mask, that gets it on someone's face at the cheapest price possible. David Dayan, you are a gift to God. He is the executive editor of the American Prospect. I think you should have a page at the Washington Post. I'm just telling you, because all the stuff that Bezos is afraid of, you write about.
If you're doing the hiring, I'll
all right, go. I'm there. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. We'll be talking to you soon. Ciao.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. It is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude. We'll see you tomorrow.
To live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to fly, I simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Who told you you're allowed to rain on my parade? Sir, at least I didn't fake it. Hat, sir, I guess I didn't make it. But whether I'm the rose of sheer perfection, or freckle on the nose of life's complexion, the cinder or the shiny apple of its eye, I gotta fly once, I gotta try once, only can die once. Right, sir. Ooh, life is juicy, juicy, and you see I'm gonna have my bite. Get ready for me, love, 'cause I'm a comer. I simply gotta march, my heart's a drummer. Don't bring around a cloud of rain on my parade. I'm gonna live and live now. Get what I want, I know how. One roll for the whole shebang. Hey, Mr. Armstead, here I am. I'll march my band out. I'll beat my drum. And if I'm found out, you turn at bat, sir. At least I didn't fake it, hat, sir. Guess I didn't make it. Get ready for me, love, 'cause I'm a comer. I simply gotta march, my heart's a reminder.